Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future.
Tonight, the governor confirming that coronavirus has arrived here in Manhattan.
This is a moment we all knew would come, but that doesn't make it any easier.
This is the 10th hospital that I have been in, and to see the heartache that goes so far and so wide, it's really hard to take.
You know, we're pouring our hearts out to the patients and the staff. I'm tired.
My hope is that we're not waiting to go back to what we call normal, but that this experience helps us shape what we want the new normal to be.
I need to make sure that folks ain't hungry, that people are secure as far as housing is concerned.
We're bound together by the loss and the pain of the days that have gone by. We're also bound together by the hope and the possibilities of the days in front of us.
I'm Kai Wright, and welcome to a special national broadcast of our show. It's an emotional moment for so many of us. This past week, we hit the official one-year mark of this pandemic. And for most of this hour, we're going to talk about all the remarkable ways in which people have taken care of one another in that time, and about the long, very much political history of that kind of communal caretaking. But we need to start with a remembrance. One out of every five people in the U.S. have lost somebody to COVID. So we begin tonight by checking in with one of those people. Gregory Porter is a Grammy-winning singer and songwriter. He's a famous guy, tours the world playing jazz and gospel and R&B. But we met him last summer to talk about his brother's fame. He was a sort of local hero here in Brooklyn, and when he died from COVID, it hit hard. Gregory is at the virtual Grammys tonight, so I checked in with him earlier this week about living with his loss. Well, Gregory, first of all, hello, and thanks for coming back on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be back with you. Yeah.
When we last spoke, your older brother, Lloyd Porter, he had just passed from COVID here in New York City. And this was last summer, so it was a moment when a lot of people were experiencing similar loss suddenly and rapidly. And you kind of helped us process all that by introducing us to your brother. And so I wonder if now you can sort of, those of our listeners who missed that episode, if you can reintroduce us to him. One of the things that I remember is it seems like he was just a constant maker of community.
Yeah. You know, people are still sending me messages about things that he's done, connections that he's made, even as a matchmaker. There are babies that are here because of him. And, you know, he's like, hey, you need to get to know this girl. And y'all need to sit over there in the corner and have a cup of coffee. This is the kind of guy he was.
Wow.
He gathered a group of people, a group of artists together, designers, photographers, videographers, for me to shoot all of my music videos, all of my first music videos. And my budget was very small, but he was just a fabulous, fabulous person in terms of just making things happen and bringing community together.
Well, in that way, it sounds like he was a bit of a mentor or a father figure for you too, right? I mean, he played this huge role in your career. You're now a multi-Grammy nominated artist, but that was, in those early days, it was Lloyd who kind of believed in you, right?
Yes, right. He believed in me. You know, before I believed in me, which is a funny thing. There's a lyric in one of my songs, Thank You, which is, I say,
rough cut stone, I couldn't polish myself, had to be done by someone else. Thank you, thank you.
A rough cut stone, I couldn't polish myself, it had to be done by someone else. You know, I'm using it in a kind of a religious casing, but I'm speaking about my brother because I thought I could sing pretty nicely, but my brother would get up on the mountaintop and say, my brother is the best singer in the world. You know, now I still don't believe that, but that's the kind of person he was for me. And he was a comedian. And the funniest comedian who never had a Pulitzer or a Grammy for his genius of comedy. But, you know, his memory and his image, his likeness is in my music.
He died on May 6th, which I gather is also your mother's birthday. That's coming up. And I kind of think about a lot of people who have lost loved ones over the last year. And I imagine there's probably a lot of anniversaries like that coming.
Yeah.
I wonder for you, if you how are you thinking about that, preparing for that? What might you say to other people who are in similar situation?
Well, I would say that the grieving process has been so profound, the way in which people died without close connection, without me touching his hand, without me seeing him physically in the same room. It's just so disconnected, so cold-blooded. And so that, I think, extended the grieving process for me. He just disappeared. He just disappeared. And I had no parts of him. A couple of things happened before he was pronounced dead. I sang to him a couple of times. And the first time I sang to him, the thought was, he's recovering, he's still there. And this will encourage him, give him some encouragement. So I'm singing my heart out. All right. Just to him. And then the next day, he had had a heart attack, and the tone, the doctor's tone was different. And he was like, sing to him, give him some encouragement. But I was looking at him on screen, and I said to myself, as I sang, he's not there. He's not there. So I was... Essentially, that was my funeral, the last time I sang to him, because I knew he was gone. And I was just singing to his soul. The healing has just come over days, really just considering just who he was as a man, who we were as little boys. And that keeps me laughing, and that keeps him alive. Yeah, you know.
One of the things that happened when your brother died was that the community had to come up with this really innovative way to remember him. We couldn't have funerals. What was that like for you to witness that? How did that impact you from afar?
Yeah, I watched from 3,000 miles away that when the community and many of my good friends walked past my brother's door of his brownstone and waved at his wife and child as they stood on their stoop. It was beautiful, painful, but beautiful to see people, almost a scene from a movie, just giving him his respect, letting his family know, letting his people know that he was loved, he was seen, and he will be missed. And the interesting thing that I did afterwards, as I watched it a few times again, I just listened to some of the comments because the microphone was just picking up random comments. And there were children didn't understand, like, where's Mr. Lloyd? And then the parents explaining as they walked away from the microphone, because there was a, you know, kind of steady procession. But then some people would stop and say, some of the things that he did, it's like, I can't believe he's gone. He's the one that helped me, you know, find my house. He's Lord, Mr. You know, and they were saying these things, standing in front of his house, and the microphone was picking up some of those things, and it was, you know, a lot of them were thinking out loud, thinking nobody was listening, and I heard some of those comments, and it was just so beautiful. It was beautiful to see, yeah.
you've written and talked about the way you've turned to music throughout this pandemic.
Yeah.
You released an album last year that is was nominated for a Grammy, but you also released a collection of songs of your work that was explicitly about helping us get through this time.
Well, I was self-medicating and have always self-medicated with music. So I wanted to put together something that was encouraging, because I realized I was going to my stereo, to my vinyls, for memory, for encouragement, for uplift. Not to sound self-important, but I went back to my songs to reaffirm what it is that I believe in, about the optimism that I have about love, irrepressible love. Sometimes I write these songs for other people, to encourage other people, not realizing one day I'll need them. So the simple phrase, "There will be no love, let's die in here," is I needed it to reaffirm that idea for myself, yeah.
Can I ask you about that song in particular? It's called No Love Dying. It's one of the songs you included in the collection. And it has this incredibly poignant lyric. It says, "The death of love is everywhere, but I won't let it be." And it just felt so 2020.
Yeah, it's about the deeper love. The physical manifestation of love can disappear, but that thing still exists. I still love my brother deeply, and I still trade love with him, but he's not here anymore. And that will continue to live no matter if he breathes or not. There's evidence of almost getting used to death, but I believe in love, and I'm fighting for love, and I'm fighting for the life of love. Yeah. Mm.
You talk so beautifully about the song. Can you sing us a few bars of it, maybe?
Sure. "There will be no love that's dying here. The bird that flew in through my window simply lost his way. He broke his wing, I helped him heal, then he flew away. Well, the death of love is everywhere, but I won't let it be. There will be no love that's dying here for me. There will be no love dying here for me."
I'm Kai Wright. This is a special national broadcast of the United States of Anxiety. We'll be right back with more of my conversation with recording artist Gregory Porter about losing his brother to COVID and the ways some of us have begun to take care of each other just a little more. Stay with us.
What if millions of Black Americans had been compensated for slavery? Join me, Trymaine Lee, as I explore the untold story of one of the only Black Americans who ever was. I talk to his descendants and discuss how reparations forever changed their family's trajectory, and imagine a reality where reparations are paid to the rest of Black America. Into America presents Uncounted Millions, The Power of Reparations, a Black History Month series. New episodes drop Thursdays. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. This is a special national broadcast of United States of Anxiety from WNYC in New York. I'm Kai Wright. We're looking back at a year in our lives with COVID-19. 1 in 5 people in the U.S. have lost someone to this virus, at least according to one survey by the Associated Press. Gregory Porter is one of those people. And before the break, he told us that one way he's mourned his brother's loss is by turning to music. Gregory is a Grammy Award-winning singer and songwriter, and in December, he made a collection of his music dedicated to people who were, like him, finding their way through grief. Gregory is at the virtual Grammys tonight, but I talked to him earlier this week about that collection. You also included Revival Song, which is from your new album. And it's a gospel-infused song to me, at least. But there's also, or maybe this isn't a but, there's also this tone of resilience and defiance in it. The sort of not just grief and the sort of syncopation at the beginning. It feels like we're marching somewhere. Tell us about that song and why you included it in this particular collection.
Yeah, well, this is the in the gospel tradition, the songs always have double meanings. You know, the River Jordan is not really the River Jordan. You know, it may be the Ohio River or the Mississippi River, or there's a double meaning.
But you lift me high up out of the fire, out of the flames.
You lift me higher out of the fire and out of the flames. You know, this idea of ascending this murk and mire and rising above this thing that we find ourselves in at the time, to a higher place, looking to something that reminds us of our strength, looking to something that that reminds us of our highest self.
Hmm. Well, Gregory, what would you leave people with? What would you say to folks as we mark a year since this pandemic began?
Yeah. The memory of this time will be really profound for all of us, even for those who haven't lost someone. There's been some beautiful things that have happened. People have helped one another get through, and let's continue to do that. And we'll need to continue to do that because there's some wounds and some scars. And so let's continue to watch each other and help each other. We will make it. We will get through this. I'm hopeful and optimistic. I know the memory of my brother will continue to inspire me and inspire my music. And I hope that that your listeners and other people will be as well. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Singing revival, revival song. I'm singing.
Gregory Porter's Revival Song from the Grammy-nominated album he released last summer, and from the collection Getting Through It, which he put together to help those who, like himself, are grieving someone they've lost in this pandemic. Gregory said he's been happy to see how people have taken care of one another over the past year, and he hopes that we'll keep doing so even after the pandemic ends. And that's what we're going to talk about for the rest of this show, coming together for communal caretaking. And not just with some facile notion of unity or the false idea that this pandemic has hit us all the same. It most certainly has not. It has rather illustrated a great many inequities and made many of them worse. And it's because of that fact, because so many people have not gotten what they need from official quarters, that community networks have sprung up to fill the gap. A lot of us have even learned a new term in this past year, mutual aid. So for the rest of the show, we're going to talk about mutual aid and learn its long and important history. And as we do, I want to hear from you. Have you started or joined any kind of communal caretaking effort during the pandemic, whatever you called it? Call us and tell us about it. What need were you trying to meet? What trouble did you encounter along the way? And what worked well? What lessons can you share? And I am joined by author and activist Dean Spade. In October, Dean published a new book from Verso Press called Mutual Aid: Building Solidarity During This Crisis and the Next. He's been studying mutual aid and, importantly, working to create mutual aid networks for decades. And he joins us from Seattle, where he is an associate professor at Seattle University School of Law. Dean, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So can we start by just helping us define some terms here? A lot of people have probably heard this term mutual aid in the past year, but maybe for the first time. It reflects a kind of general idea about taking care of each other, the mutual part, but it also has a really specific idea that is distinct from community service or volunteering. So can you just explain that idea?
Yeah, totally. So when I use the term mutual aid, what I'm thinking of is the part of social movement work where people are getting together to meet each other's immediate survival needs with a shared understanding that the crisis that people are facing is not the fault of the people facing the crisis, but the systems that have produced the crisis and are worsening it. So it's not just, it's not just kind of like feel good volunteerism. It's also got teeth. There's something in it that's connected to social movement work that says, hey, what are the root causes of these problems? Why are the same people always left on the bottom? Why are these systems so extractive and produce an extreme crisis for some people when the storm rolls in or the pandemic rolls in? And so it's, mutual aid, as you mentioned, has become a pretty popular term in the last year. And when terms mainstream, sometimes it can be hard to tell what the meaning is because they get used in a lot of ways. But the way I use it in my work, and I think the way people in social movements have used it for a long time, is to talk about that part of our social movement work that is the direct survival work to support each other.
Mm-hmm. So it's tied to the root causes of the problem that you're addressing. It's also, there's an important distinction here from charity work. What is the distinction and why is that important?
Yeah, that's great. So charity, a lot of us think of mutual aid as the opposite of charity, because charity is generally when elites, rich people, governments, sometimes religions historically, are, organizing aid for people in crisis, but with the idea that there is something wrong with those people, that we're going to figure out who's the deserving poor and the undeserving poor. So you can only have this if you're the widow of a veteran, but not if you're one of these loose women, or you shouldn't have this if you're undocumented, or you should only have this if you're sober. Charity usually deploys eligibility criteria that moralizes people's poverty and says that it's the fault of the people who are in crisis. And mutual aid is the opposite. It says the crisis is the fault of the system, and so everybody should have what they need right now, and we're not going to deploy moralizing exclusions that keep the most stigmatized people out of the relief. And so most social services that we all know about in our towns, most sort of nonprofit frameworks, do this exact thing. They exclude people unless they're sober, or unless they take these or those meds, or unless they're documented, all of these pieces. And so mutual aid tends to be volunteer-based and collectively run, and really centering the dignity and wisdom of people facing the crisis, instead of saying, oh, there's some elites who really know what's good for you, and if you took this budgeting class and if you took this parenting class, then maybe eventually we'd make you eligible for this thing we're giving out.
We already heard from a few listeners this week about their own experiences with mutual aid. And I want to play a couple of voicemails we got because they might help illustrate the idea. So first, here's Tori from Tacoma, Washington.
It's been really amazing to work with all these people that I didn't know before COVID started. And frankly, to work with them mostly virtual, like we've really never met in person. A few times we've done grocery distribution all together, but socially distanced and masked. So it's really people from all walks of life who've signed up to help. And we have a regular crew now who does it every week. Knowing that if I needed something like this, that I really feel like my community would step up and be there. And so, I don't know, I like being that for other people.
So that's Tori. And here is Madeline from Baltimore, Maryland.
I joined a mutual aid group at the beginning of the pandemic in our city. I was unemployed. I was laid off from both my jobs because of the pandemic. And I wanted to get involved with the community more with all the free time I had. It led to a couple of amazing revelations for me. My own thoughts about scarcity, scarcity of love, scarcity of money, and understand that those are stories that my culture has told me. It feels a lot easier to share generously now, even though I've gone from an $80,000 income to a $13,000 a year income. I'm giving more than I ever was.
And Dean, I want to hear you talk about anything you heard in that, but one of the reasons I played them is that there's in both of those, there's this, the idea of mutual, the idea that you may need aid one day and have it to give the next day. So there's nothing special about being at either end of that spectrum. It's almost like, at least in my family, how I was raised to believe what family is really the core idea here. But did you hear anything in those messages that you want to pick up on or adjust to?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I hear, people find participating in mutual aid projects very like deeply heartening, because we live in a culture that just, as Madeline was saying, like tells us to experience scarcity, to distrust others, to just kind of get what you can for yourself and hoard it just for your tiny family. And we have a sort of vibrant sci-fi TV world that tells us that, you know, difficult times will come with like armed bands just protecting our own. But in reality, when crisis strikes, people tend to really show up and help each other out in huge numbers and demonstrate a kind of generosity that's, you know, transformative for people. It's so countercultural to care about people you don't know and who are different from you, and to work with people you don't know and who are different from you for the good and well-being of all, and to make decisions together instead of waiting for some boss to tell you how it's supposed to be. So I think people have very big transformative changes happen in them from doing this work. And one other piece that relates to what you just said is that it mutually deeply destigmatizes poverty. I always think about this wonderful movie I saw about the Black Panther Party, where this woman interviewed and her family went to the free breakfast, and she talked about how, you know, you're feeling like there's something wrong with you, that you can't feed your children, right? There's something bad about you, that you're poor. And then you go to this place and people are like, no, it's white supremacy that's making everybody poor. Let's have breakfast together and talk about how to take it down. And how like, I have chills just saying that to you. Like, just, it was her delivery, of course, was even better because it happened to her. She was one of these children who's eating this breakfast and seeing this destigmatization. But I think that's very meaningful in a culture that tells us that good people will rise to the top, and if you're on the bottom, there's something that you've done wrong.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of the mutual part of it, also, you know, you have studied this, but you also come to it as an organizer in racial justice movements, in queer and trans liberation movements. And you have a personal relationship to mutual aid work as well. Would you mind telling your own story of turning to mutual aid in moments of crisis?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I feel like everything about my survival has been shaped by mutual aid, you know, as I think is the case of so many people. Certainly, you know, I came of age in a queer and trans movement in the 90s in which people were doing a lot of harm reduction work, and we were doing a lot of support for people with HIV and AIDS. And some of the first mutual aid work I was involved in was directly supporting people trying to navigate the New York City like welfare authority who had HIV and AIDS and were not getting what they were supposed to get. And we were going to the offices with them and staying and not letting the offices close until they gave people the housing they were supposed to get and that kind of thing. But I also have had my own experiences of like, I think that mutual aid is both specific projects that people enter, like, you know, Tacoma Mutual Aid or whatever it is, but it's also an ethic inside radical or left movements. So I'm remembering I think of a moment for me where I really was on the receiving end of mutual aid was this time in 2002 when I was arrested for using a bathroom in Grand Central Station. You know, this is a typical thing that happens to trans people. We get arrested for using bathrooms and other kinds of basic survival needs. And not only did two people who were there with me, who were friends of mine, like jump in and try to tear the cops off of me, which I think is mutual aid, and they both got arrested, but then also a community of people outside who knew me came together and figured out who were the lefty lawyers and you know, called those people and figured out how to stand up for me in court. And there was a lot of people in court when I had to appear. And it was a really scary experience, as you can imagine. And I experienced transphobia from my court-appointed lawyer. So it was a really big deal that these people gave me a lawyer that worked. And it was, you know, people put pressure on the city to drop the charges. Mm-hmm. And that's a very typical kind of mutual aid in left movements and also in queer and other marginalized and criminalized communities, like court support and defense campaigns, like, you know, Survive and Punished is a great group that has a New York chapter that people may know of that does defense campaigns for criminalized people who've been criminalized for surviving violence, you know, fought back against their attacker and whatnot.
Let's try to get in a caller before we have to go to break. Let's talk to Nula from Queens. Nula, welcome to the show.
So a year ago, I put a post-it on my neighbor's door because I realized that my neighbors didn't know my phone number and just said, if you need anything, call me. And I started a Facebook page and it became something called COVID Care Neighbor Network. And within a month, we had over 100 volunteers. And initially, we're just serving the immediate needs of our neighbors. But I live in Jackson Heights, Queens, which is an immigrant neighborhood. And it really quickly became clear that the government just didn't care about our undocumented neighbors. They didn't get a stimulus check. They didn't get unemployment. They didn't even get food stamps. So it really became just a way to advocate for them to get food. And now people in my group, we distribute over 2,000 boxes of food for our neighbors every week. And it's really become a movement. And I think our community is stronger now than it was before COVID.
Wow. Thank you for that. Dean, just quickly, that 2,000 boxes of food, can you talk about the way, the scale this might be able to hit?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that I look forward to when the studies are going to come out about how widespread the COVID mutual aid has been, because there are just endless stories like what Nuala just shared. And I think that many of us believe that, you know, we're going to continue to see an erosion of, I mean, you know, the economy, the climate, like we're going to be facing a lot more crises. And the work we're doing now to support people during COVID is actually going to be important for the next time the storm hits, the blackout, all of the things that are coming in to all of our communities that, you know, we just saw in Texas, but we've been seeing it, you know, worsening and worsening for years. And so I think many of us believe that we could have a society that really runs on mutual aid, especially as we see, I think, U.S. empire crumble in some ways, and you know, the long history of the U.S. putting more and more of its resources towards militarism, policing, and immigration enforcement, and less towards people's basic needs. We start to imagine, like, what does it look like? Of course, many communities have already been left out for a long time, as Nuala said, but what does it look like if we all start really taking care of each other, of course, while we fight to dismantle these horrible systems that are criminalizing and harming us? And that, I think, that level of scale is not about, like, sort of centralizing mutual aid, but instead about this proliferation of many, 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 many local projects based in local wisdoms that can do this kind of crisis support really well, and be run locally by the people there who are part of that community, instead of something from, like, on high.
I'm Kai Wright, and I'm talking with Dean Spade about the history of mutual aid and the ways in which people have discovered and rediscovered the idea during the pandemic. Stay with us.
Hey everyone, this is Carolyn Adams, the associate producer for the United States of Anxiety. This past year has been really hard. And even though there's some light, we're still not out of this tunnel. But here on the show, we've been trying to understand why and just how this pandemic hit our communities so hard. So we invite you to reflect with us and check out our collection, What COVID Revealed. It's a curated list of episodes in which we explored what love and loss, resistance, and resilience looked like this year. There's a link to it in this episode's show notes, but you can also find it on our website, wnyc.org/anxiety. If you click the tab at the top, labeled Collections, you'll see What COVID Revealed listed there. We hope that these episodes will bring you some peace and understanding in these trying times.
Welcome back. This is a special national broadcast of United States of Anxiety from WNYC in New York. I'm Kai Wright. We're looking back at a year in our lives with COVID-19, and we're focused on the ways in which communities have come together to take care of themselves, as so many of the institutions that were supposed to form a safety net have failed to do so. I'm joined by author and activist Dean Spade. In October, Dean published a new book from Verso Press called Mutual Aid, Building Solidarity During This Crisis and the Next. He's been organizing and studying this stuff for decades and may have advice on how to face any challenges you've encountered. And let's start with Jay in Los Angeles. Jay, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for calling. What has been your experience?
I'm a substitute teacher in the Los Angeles Unified School District. When the pandemic hit, the district began a project called Grab and Go, where we offered food to needy families. People just had to drive through, stop the cars. We'd put the food into the trunk or into the back seat of the car, and they'd drive off. And you could get up to six meals or six packages a day. When they first asked for help, about 1,500 of us subs volunteered. They couldn't even take us all at the same time, but I did three two-week shifts of helping distribute the food. And if they had extra at the end of the day, they couldn't put it back, we'd take it away. And if I saw somebody on the street who needed it, I gave it. I have a couple of neighbors who I was sharing with. We were feeding. That was the deal.
Yeah.
And had you done anything like that before?
Not in the same way. I have served as Jewish clergy, and I have done a little bit of feeding the homeless at my former billet in southeast Los Angeles County. Mm-hmm. But that was relatively spot thing. This was, you know, every weekday for a total of 6 weeks.
Right. And what did you learn? I mean, what was the hardest part of it, I'd say?
The hardest part of it was thinking that a lot of the people who came to us had no place else to go. I guess we were glad to be able to help those people.
Mm. Well, thank you for that, Jay. Let's go to Maggie in Minnesota. Maggie, welcome to the show.
Hi.
How you doing? Hey. Thanks for calling. What was your experience?
Well, I feel like my whole life I have seen and experienced mutual aid. It never really had a name. But, you know, everybody I know who's a part of the poor working class, maybe a lower middle class, is kind of sharing like the same $15 around over and over again. And it's been interesting in the last year to just see it have a name and see the middle class and upper middle classes participating in it more and seeing so many efforts. And I really appreciate it. But I do think it's important to acknowledge that, you know, working class people, poor people have always taken care of each other because they can see exactly how easy it is for the bottom to fall out, right? And to see how vulnerable you can be when you don't have a lot of money. And so when you do have an extra 15, 10 bucks, you'll give it to somebody who might need a little bit of extra support and, you know, GoFundMes and whatnot. And I just think trust is the hardest thing to establish. And it's been nice to see, especially in Minneapolis, just the fact that there's already kind of established trust there. And so there's a lot of support for us, you know, here.
Thank you for that, Maggie. Dean, can I ask you about something Maggie said there about the fact that this has been going on a long time? We've sort of touched on this a little bit in the conversation, but to go in for it a bit, this mutual aid has been a core part of so many social movements. And is it fair to say that maybe the most intense period of that was in the 60s and 70s, both in sort of Black and Puerto Rican movements for self-determination and in queer communities? If so, can you talk about sort of that history and how it was used in those movements?
No, that's a great question. And I really appreciate what Maggie said about the fact that working class people and people who are stigmatized and marginalized are always surviving by taking care of each other. Because the systems that are supposed to do relief, like disaster relief or poor relief, are actually designed to leave certain people out, right? There's like, you know, they always have been designed in racialized and gendered ways, in ways that leave out immigrants, in ways that leave out queer and trans people, et cetera. And they're always designed to be inadequate because the point of them is to force people to work at any wage under any conditions. So there's always a whole set of people who have to be on the very bottom, both to warn the rest of us who are not there right now, you'll mm-hmm. fall there and be and die in the street if you don't do exactly what we say. Because people are sort of exempted out by these criteria. So I just really appreciate that. And mutual aid is very visible during COVID because it's this global pandemic happening everywhere at once. But it's a consistent feature in all of those communities and in all of those social movement struggles. Like the struggle to abolish prisons always has included and still includes support for people in prisons, right? The mm-hmm. support for people in detention centers, et cetera. Yeah, I think that the 60s and 70s were a flashpoint where we see it's kind of the last moment, I think, before right now, major uprising against white supremacy, war, sexism, capitalism, colonialism in the U.S. And so many people were active. And so the mutual aid is very visible there. I think that that's true in every movement across time. But that's a really important and fun place for us to look. And some of the examples people really, you know, the flashpoint examples people look at are, of course, the Black Panther Party's free breakfast programs, but they also had many other programs like health clinics and ambulance service and, you know, tons and tons of programs. And also the Young Lords, right, people who were working for Puerto Rican liberation, both the decolonization of Puerto Rico and Puerto Rican liberation for people in the U.S. And they were doing, you know, they're famous for their trash strike. They were both picking up trash and throwing it in the middle of the street to make a point about the ways that Puerto Rican neighborhoods were neglected by the city of New York. They hijacked mobile x-ray unit that the city of New York used to test people for tuberculosis that the Young Lords felt didn't come to the Puerto Rican community at accessible times for the population, and there was a lot of TB. So they hijacked the truck and brought it to the Puerto Rican community when they thought it was needed. So it was mutual aid with teeth. They took over part of Lincoln Hospital. You know, it was about serving the people, and they did serve the people a lot, but it was also an indictment of the system. And many other movements of that time had health clinics. I think that's also a crossover we can see. So there was the emergence of gay health clinics at that time, tons and tons of projects of the feminist health movement. There was people mm-hmm. giving each other what were illegal abortions. There were people trying to teach sexual health to each other, trying to spotlight on Black health and Native health by directly doing healthcare for each other, some people being professionals and many people being lay people who were trained to do things and doing it all for free, on the fly, out of vans, you know, out of storefronts. This kind of like, we can do it, and we're going to create the world we want to live in right now instead of waiting for someone to come save us. Go ahead.
Well, I was just saying, it's funny because you don't think of those are all such explicitly political projects and direct action in some cases. You're describing, you know, civil disobedience. And I wonder if you see that too in any of the COVID era mutual aid.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think one example here in Seattle, but I'm following these kinds of struggles all over the country. We have a lot more visible homeless population, people living in encampments in parks because people are, you know, the economic conditions have worsened severely, yet housing costs are at an all-time high. And so people have been defending those encampments when the police try to raid them. So it's like people are bringing water to the encampments and bringing food and helping people have tents, but then they're also sort of fighting the cops. There's also Street Watch LA is another group that I've watched doing that. That's, you know, stood in front of the sanitation trucks that come to clear the homeless encampments. I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of that as rent becomes due and back rent becomes due, because we're still not seeing real relief from that coming from the government. So I think we'll be seeing more mutual aid with teeth, but we can also see this like recent examples, like I'm sure many people followed, you know, No More Deaths. They support people who are crossing the border and often crossing through desert conditions. And they put water out for people and they put clothing out for people and they help find people's remains and identify them. They do this really powerful work. The Trump administration had their medical camps raided in the last few years of the administration. So we can see how there's nothing unusual about mutual aid work being criminalized, being repressed by the government. And I do think there's a danger with the mainstreaming of the term right now for people to only want to think about the mutual aid work that doesn't make them uncomfortable or doesn't mm-hmm. try to get at root causes or challenge the conditions themselves. But we need to see it. It is mutual aid work when it is part of a broader awareness that we are going to resist conditions. Because, you know, as the glass caller was saying, like, if we're passing around the same $15 to each other, we're not, like, that alone will not get us out of these, you know, miserable conditions in which people's lives end early. We also need to fight the systems that that make certain people so poor so that other people can be made so rich.
Let's hear from Nate in Philadelphia. Nate, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me. My name is Nate. I worked with Occupy Sandy during the hurricane, but when the pandemic started, I run a nonprofit that deals with food and farming, and we started a project that's become something called the Cooperative Gardens Commission, coopgardens.org, and our biggest project is distributing free seeds. We get seeds donated from seed companies. We had folks around the country apply to be a local or regional seed hub, and then we repackage seeds and send them out. We're just doing it right now for this year. We got seeds last year to 257 local regional seed hubs in 41 states. We think we got seeds to at least 12,000 gardens so that people could help to feed themselves and their communities. We prioritize Black and brown communities, indigenous communities. And we're all volunteer, have a bunch of working groups working by Zoom and conference call. And we've got a policy working group trying to get at some of those root causes and build coalitions with other organizations doing similar work. And it's, not how I expected my pandemic year to go, but would not be doing anything else.
Nate, you mentioned Occupy Sandy at the beginning there. There is some history here that a lot of folks learned about mutual aid in the course of the Occupy movement. Was that the case for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I probably had heard the term mutual aid before, but when Sandy hit, I was living in the Philadelphia area, and a lot of my friends were involved with Occupy Wall Street and got Occupy Sandy started, and a bunch of us in Philly got Occupy Sandy New Jersey started, and we just, that ended up being about a year and a half of my life. And I, you know, I so many lessons that I took from that were applied to this work, and pretty much our whole organizational structure is based on that. We practice consensus-based decision-making, and we're a decentralized, non-hierarchical collective, and it's, it served us really well. You know, you don't want to be duplicating the systems of oppression that led you to the problem in the first place.
Thank you for calling, Nate. Let's hear from Lucy in Bed-Stuy. Lucy, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for calling. What's been your experience?
I actually, very similar to the last caller, I also had plugged in very intensely during Occupy Sandy, and it had kind of been dormant in me until the pandemic started. And I organize right now alongside a group called IOH NYC, and they started the first community fridge in New York City. Last February, actually, right before the pandemic started. And now there's nearly 100 in the five boroughs and in New Jersey, and it's really taken off across the whole country, which if anyone doesn't know, a community fridge is a fridge open on public property. They're pretty much open 24/7, and they're stocked with healthy, rescued food that would have otherwise been wasted.
Thank you for that, Lucy. Dean, so two people who had some roots in previous movements, particularly Occupy. Can you talk about that sort of on-ramp in and out of political movements through mutual aid?
Yeah, I think that most people who join movements actually join through mutual aid because either you show up because you need something and these people are giving it out and they're also saying like, hey, we don't think it's your fault that you need this. Would you like to join collective action to, you know, deal with the fact that this situation has been created, this crisis has been created, and you get invited into other social movement work, including continuing the mutual aid project, or possibly also like, oh, we're all going to go to the transit riders union event, or, oh, we're all going to go block the bridges and tunnels for, you know, to oppose this, or we're going to do this thing with prisoners or whatever. And the other way people get involved in movements often is that they are upset about something that's going on. And they're like, I want to get involved. And when you first want to get involved, what you mainly want to do is help someone. Like, this is a kind of beautiful thing about humans. Like, either like, this thing happened to me and now I want to help somebody who it's happening to now, or this thing happened to someone I love, or whatever the case may be, or heard about in the news. So mutual aid tends to be the on-ramp because it's where people often first interact with social movements. I think this is really clear, like, you know, during the summer, there was this occupation of this park in Seattle that was called the CHOP, the occupied protest zone. Maybe people were following that. And the police left the precinct there, and there was, you know, people hanging out there and living there and gardening there. And similarly, there was an occupation at City Hall in the summer and in New York City and many places. And these occupations, when you look at them, what they are to the eye is a bunch of mutual aid tents. Like, that's, if you're like, oh, I think I want to get involved with what's going on down there, you go there. It's actually going to be because someone hands you a bottle of water or a flyer for free, you know, to come to this dance party or come to this discussion group. It's like, when you get somewhere, it is mutual aid that is what touches you. And it's the people who are offering something. That's who's your first contact, a friendly contact, when you're like, I think I want to be part of this. So mutual aid is like central to the building of powerful social movements. And a lot of people, I love that the caller talked about like making consensus decisions together and like learning about group process. Like, we're in the groups and we're both learning together about, you know, who's affected by this, and wow, there's some aspects of this problem I didn't know about, or no one had, I'd actually never worked with trans people before. I didn't know how this affects undocumented people. And then you're also learning about like, how do groups of people make decisions together when like no one's getting paid to be someone's boss or someone's employee? Like, we're all just choosing to be here. How can we be in a way together that makes us want to stay and treat each other well? And that means shaking off a lot of the social norms that we've all been conditioned by that might tell us to like dominate each other or play out our racist or sexist stuff or whatever the case may be. So mutual aid spaces are also spaces where people like practice the skills for the world we're trying to build while we build it, and hopefully that as many of us as possible survive to get there. So I think it's an on-ramp in multiple ways.
Practice the world we're trying to build while we're building it. I like that in sentiment. Dean Spade is author most recently of the book Mutual Aid, Building Solidarity During This Crisis and the Next. Thanks for joining us, Dean.
Thanks for having me.
United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Joe Plourd mixed the podcast version. Kevin Bristow and Matthew Mirando at the boards for the live show. A special thanks this week to producer Carl Boisrond for help answering the phones and getting callers onto the radio. Our team also includes Carolyn Adams, Emily Botine, Ginny Casas, Karen Froman, and Christopher Wirth. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Vera Lynn Williams is our executive producer, and I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. That's Kai_Wright, like the brothers. And as always, I hope you'll join us for the live version of the show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. You can stream it at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker, play WNYC. Until then, thanks for listening and take care of yourselves.